Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barack Obama was clear as a bell on the campaign trail. Change was coming to Washington, not least a change in ethics. Then came time to govern in a system loaded with money and apparently cut corners. Tim Geithner squeaked in after unpaid taxes as Treasury Secretary. Yesterday, nominees Tom Daschle and Nancy Killefer bailed out under fire over tax issues and, in Daschle's case, lobbying world money. It's left a lot of ordinary tax-paying Americans shaking their heads. This hour on Point, taxes, lobbying money, and the Washington elite. You can join the conversation. How do you read the headlines out of Washington on ethics, taxes, big money? Can Obama set it right? Will he? We have a couple of terrific guests with us today. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author of Perfectly Legal, the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else, and Free Lunch, how the wealthiest Americans enrich themselves at government expense and stick you with the bill. He joins us from Rochester, New York. David, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Washington is Robert Bob Kaiser, associate editor at The Washington Post and author of the eye-popping new book, So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government. Bob, good to have you.
Nice to have you, and thanks for that eye-popper. It was
good. You're right there in Washington, Bob Kaiser. What do you make of what we've seen in the last 24 hours here?
Well, it's a wonderful, remarkable Washington story. I think that the new Obama gang came up against a reality which they themselves understood very well in the campaign, which was the country's aching appetite for real change. But they discovered that it extended even to one of their very favorite figures, Tom Daschle, who, you know, was a really important mentor to Barack Obama, encouraged him to run for president, and then asked numerous aides and associates who'd worked with Daschle over the years to go to work for Obama, which they have done. So it's a figure who was, he was very closely tied up in the Obama phenomenon, but he also, we now know vividly, was very swept up in this culture of corruption in Washington, which is the subject of my book, and which is pretty depressing. And what's really striking to me is that Tom Daschle thought he ought to have a Cadillac and a chauffeur. He thought he ought to make $2 million from a law firm, although he wasn't even a lawyer. And, you know, I just know that if we had Daschle on the program with us and said, how come? He'd have to say, if he was being honest, well, everybody does it. And that's, of course, the problem. For many, many years, trading in your public service for private gain has been the name of the game in Washington, and almost everybody has done it. Well, that's not fair. A great many people have done it, including many, many former members of Congress. And Daschle thought he was doing something quite unexceptional, I'm sure.
Unremarkable. And not just $2 million, but $5.2 million in total since he left the Senate. David K. Johnston, you know, taxes like nobody's business. Everybody was watching. I mean, this is the time of year when Americans are getting their records together, pulling out all those files, getting their forms in the mail and stashing them away, getting ready to try and do the right thing. And here we've got these examples where it seemed as though, in both Geithner and Daschle's case, not that they have to be saints, but it seemed as though they might well have known, should have known, maybe did know that they were trimming here.
Well, I think in Geithner's case, the evidence is quite clear that he knew what he was doing. He behaved improperly. We have a system to address that. And I'm glad you used that word saints, because I don't think that if you take care of your tax problem and you were not openly defying the system, you weren't fabricating records and things like that, that you should have to do more than the penalty. You should pay the interest. You should pay the taxes. And whether or not the IRS assesses them, to show that you're honorable, you should pay the taxes, which you should pay the penalties on the taxes.
They did all that, but should it take the scrutiny of a cabinet nominee to bring that to light? I mean, is there not only an assumption, as Robert Kaiser says, that people will trade in their public service for money, maybe big money, once they're out? But is there also a kind of assumption in this, I don't know what to call it, social set, power elite, you name it, that, you know, who was it who said, Helmsley, you know, Leona Helmsley, taxes are for little people.
Well, now you get, Tom, to one of the major themes I've hit upon, which is, you know, we've first of all made it easy for people in these positions, unlike wage earners, to cheat. And we have this culture that has said taxes are not part of a social compact. Taxes are not part of the obligation of citizenry. They're just a cost to be gotten rid of. It is a corrosive culture. It is another side of the coin that Bob examines brilliantly in his book, by the way, which I'm reading right now. And there's no question that this is a core problem. Washington has become a place that acts as if government is a power unto itself and that it is not subject to the fundamental rules of moral conduct that all of us are supposed to follow if we're going to have an enduring free society.
And then, David, you've got the story of Nancy Killefer, who was supposed to be chief White House performance officer, high-powered consultant out of McKinsey, with actually relatively very small little bill here, under $1,000, 900 some. I still don't completely understand. It was unemployment taxes, unpaid, a lien against her house, however, in Washington because of it. She bowed out first. Was the woman taking the hit? Why is it women who go first when it comes to the nanny tax issue?
Yes, it's interesting that it's the woman who owed the tiny amount of money here who immediately pulled the plug. But in her case, this is just sheer dumbness because you can easily, legally avoid the nanny tax. All you have to do is hire a service instead of an individual. And if you have an individual that you're hiring, especially someone who's a lawyer or has other expertise, spend a few dollars, help them set themselves up as a business. Now you have a contractor relationship, and you no longer are responsible for the taxes. You pay your fee to the contractor. And that people get caught up with this, especially after the Kimball Wood episode early at the beginning of the Clinton administration.
Not to mention her Zoe Baird long before that.
Yes.
And still,
yes, it is just astonishing that we have these problems continuing to arise. Now, there's a group of people who want to say, well, this just shows the tax code is too complex. Well, it is. I wouldn't dispute that for a minute. But nonetheless, these are people who have well-paid tax advisors. The Geithner used software that warns you, did you fill out this box? Did you pay that tax? As well as, by the way, signing a statement when he worked at the International Monetary Fund.
That he was aware of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm aware of this, and I know that I'm obligated to pay the tax. So there's a deeper problem here, and it's about how people in Washington are developing this culture that, you know, we're imperial. We're different than the rest of you. We don't have to play by the rules we impose on you.
I want to look at that culture, maybe a piece of it, Bob Kaiser, I want to ask you about, is why Barack Obama, I mean, until he didn't, he did stand by these people. Now, I don't know when he learned about Nancy Killefer's situation. Daschle, though he's supposedly knew as early as last summer, not clear that Obama knew, but there was a period here in the short time he's been in office where he seemed to be saying, and did say, I know they've got problems, but they're so important to us, to this country, to my government, that I'm going to overlook these things, in spite of his emphasis on ethics. Why, Bob Kaiser, is the talent pool so thin in Washington that you've got to have warts on your candidates?
Hey, good questions. I don't think that Daschle did tell Obama last June that he had this potential problem.
Right.
And I think that was a real disfavor to the new president on his part. The other thing is I referred to earlier, I think there is a really special relationship between Tom Daschle and Barack Obama, which Obama hated the idea, I'm sure, that he would have to give up on this friend of his who'd been so helpful to him. But the problem here is what David has so well described, is this kind of sense of entitlement. What Obama said, curiously, was in both Geithner and Daschle's cases, you know, there's no evidence that they were trying to cheat, that it wasn't willful. Well, as David and any other tax expert can explain, it was willfully avoiding understanding your obligations that led them into these problems. It wasn't simple innocence. It wasn't just, you know, forgetting to dot a T and an I or cross a T. It was they had to think, as Tom Daschle did, that using a Cadillac and a chauffeur for 3 years was just a friendly gesture that had no economic or tax implications. Nonsense. But that is the modern Washington. Now, Obama, I think I wrote in a piece in the Post last Sunday that Obama really did understand us meaning Washington. He had the gift of a good anthropologist. He was here only 4 years as a senator, and really less because he started running for president 2 years ago. But he saw this culture and spoke about it during the campaign with remarkable accuracy and candor.
The money game, the racket, the bought and paid for policy.
Exactly. He said the most poignant line to me, he said at one point, politics has become not a mission, but a business. And that's right. That's the subject of my book. And the wonderful title of my book, if I say so myself, So Damn Much Money, came from Bob Strauss, you know, Robert Strauss, mm-hmm. the former Democratic National Chairman, who I asked to explain why had the lobbying business gone so crazy? Why had it boomed so in the years that he had been in it? And Strauss thought about that for a minute. He just said, well, you know, there's just so damn much money in it. And that's, you know, the larger tragedy is there's been so damn much money in Washington. Washington has become a venue for the great American pastime, which is not baseball, but making money. And we've got that now. We're stuck with it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about taxes, lobbying, the Washington elite, and President Barack Obama on the spot over ethics and cabinet nominees. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston is with us, author of Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal. Robert Kaiser, associate editor of the Washington Post, is here. His new book about lobbying and big money politics in Washington is called So Damn Much Money. Here's Timothy Geithner taking time out from his confirmation hearings before he was finally approved, before the Senate Finance Committee. Here he is on January 21st talking about concerns over his taxes.
These were careless mistakes, but they were unintentional. I want to apologize to the committee for putting you in the position of having to spend so much time on these issues when there is so much pressing business before the country.
He wrote off his son's summer camp, not allowed. And that was just the beginning of taxes unpaid there. Yesterday, Senator John Ensign, Republican, Nevada, said it was a good thing that Tom Daschle withdrew his nomination. The Secretary for Health and Human Services went on to say that Daschle's move helped save President Obama from more public embarrassment.
President Obama has said that he wants to stop the revolving door, that he doesn't want lobbyists as part of his administration. Well, I don't know how you get paid $2 million by a lobbying firm and not call yourself a lobbyist. That just seems disingenuous to me, and I don't think passes a smell test. So I personally think that Senator Daschle, was going to face some tough questions, and to stop an embarrassment from happening for this president, I think he saved the president from being embarrassed next week in a public hearing.
And then the president himself all over the network news last night in previously scheduled interviews. Here he is with NBC's Brian Williams saying, hey, he did all right in with the Homeland Security, Energy Department, Education. But here, well, he screwed up.
Everybody, I think, acknowledges that, you know, you look at somebody like Janet Napolitano or Stephen Chu or Arne Duncan. Outstanding cabinet members, and we've got equally outstanding sub-cabinet members. Did I screw up in this situation? Absolutely, and I'm willing to take my lumps. That's part of the job here.
Did I screw up? Absolutely, said the new President Obama. David K. Johnston and Robert Kaiser are with us. Let's get a call from Barnardsville, North Carolina. Milt, you're on the line. You're on the air, Milt.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah.
I've spent 10 years of my life as an elected official in local government, and this cultural effect is all the way through America, not just in Washington, looking at this manipulation of power, this elitism mindset. My question is, how is the Obama regime going to set a shift in reframing this mindset that creates all of this abuse of power, this ego that is so destructive in elitism, and the corporate chaos that we're finding cascading, and that how are they going to meet the needs of Americans today when you're fighting this need to reframe that mindset?
Milt, that's about as big a question as you could ask, and yet it's about as concrete and important as you could ask. Bob Kaiser, what do you say?
Well, the answer has to be that we confront this culture in Washington and say no more. And interestingly, that is what Obama was doing on his second day in office when he signed that executive order saying that no lobbyists could come into the government and that nobody who came into the government could then turn around and become a lobbyist as long as he was in power.
But you've also written this won't be solved by presidential fiat.
And it won't. And, of course, they immediately said, but we'll have to make some exceptions in special circumstances. And there are already three of them that have been – there have been three waivers already to that standard. There are three former lobbyists already coming into the administration because they've said that we can't do without them, which I think is certainly not the case. I mean, they've appointed a man to be Deputy Secretary of Defense who worked for the Raytheon Corporation and did lobby for Raytheon.
William Lynn.
And there are many other qualified people that could have gotten that job. I'm baffled by that one. Geithner is picking somebody whose name I'm not going to think of right here, who's coming into the Treasury Department, similarly a lobbyist. I think it proves Milt's point about how deeply entrenched this is, but it doesn't yet show the path to the promised land. I mean, this is going to be hard, and I think the Daschle episode is probably very educational for Obama. I've sent him a copy of my book. I hope he reads it to understand how deep this thing is entrenched deeply and how hard it's going to be to extricate the country and the city from it. But it can be done. I think the revolving door can be slammed shut. I think you can force, for example, all contacts between lobbyists and members of Congress or their staffs or members of the staff of the executive branch to be reported in real time. You could have a rule that says on the internet at the end of every day, every official who's met with a lobbyist has to report who that lobbyist was and what they talked about. That would really be a nice change. It wouldn't solve the whole problem, but it would be a step in a direction which acknowledges that lobbying and influence peddling has distorted the governmental process for many, many years, and that it's time to change all that. It could be done, but it's going to take a lot of political will. And, David said earlier and what Milt implied in his comment by telephone just now, the players here are used to the way things have been done. They really think that's how it goes. That's the way it works. That's what has to be changed, and that's a big challenge.
$128,000 in back taxes and interest in Tom Daschle's case, $43,000 in Tim Geithner's case, under $1,000 in Nancy Killefer's, but she's out. David K. Johnson, what about from a tax perspective here? The phrases our caller Milt uses are manipulation of power, elitism mindset. That's the prism through which you've looked at taxes and who pays and who doesn't in this country as well. Is that open to change?
Well, one of the things I hope is that we take these lemons and we get some lemonade out of them. In my column in Tax Notes, I've called on Geithner to take four steps to reestablish his character. And one of them is to begin the work of getting us a new tax system, one that treats all taxpayers equally. We currently have two tax systems, separate and unequal.
What do you mean?
One is for wage earners. Mm-hmm. The government takes the taxes out of your check before you get it. It knows exactly what you made.
And that's that.
It knows everything else they need to know mm-hmm. to calculate your tax. The other is for business owners, people like in the situation Mr. Daschle was in, where the government basically trusts you to self-report. Well, that doesn't work. We know that system doesn't work. And we need to get a new system that treats all taxpayers fairly.
Is that anywhere on the horizon? Have you heard that in the Obama program? He's got a lot standing on his plate. But is that?
Well, I don't think it's on his front burner at the moment, but I assure you I'm going to keep hounding away at this issue that how are we going to get to a 21st century tax system? I do think there is one important development that happened in this. You know, in the previous administration, where there was a lot of public upset with lobbyists who were put in charge of various agencies that led to Obama being elected, we also had a president who wouldn't admit mistakes. I believe the first flat-out admission of error by the White House in the last administration was in an article I wrote in the New York Times in the summer of 2006. This president yesterday gave all the networks interviews saying, "I screwed up. I handled this wrong. I'm trying to learn a lesson here." That's a very important step. Now the question is, will he follow through and will he, in fact, do what he said? Did he really learn his lesson? And only time is going to tell.
Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. What do you see?
It seems to me that we are really reaping what we have sown over the past 30 or more years. And when Reagan stood up and said government is not the solution, government is the problem, he helped foster an attitude that somehow we're not all responsible for the community well-being here. And more recently, last fall, when Joe Biden was talking about tax cuts for the middle class, He was asked, well, are you going to raise taxes on people over 250? Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, it's time for them to be patriotic and help pitch in and get America out of this rut. And he was ridiculed from pillar to post. There were ads run against him. The idea that it's somehow patriotic to pay your taxes is completely gone, and we're treated like chumps if we actually pay our taxes.
But here you've got Obama-Biden nominees, Mark, who didn't pay theirs. Now, are we making too much of this, or is that a sign that the attitude you don't like is there even in the Democratic side of the coin?
It has pervaded our society. That's what I meant when I said mm-hmm. we've reaped what we've sown. For 30 years or more, we've been hearing this this mantra. The tax rate in the 50s and early 60s, as you know, was vastly greater than it is now. It's gotten worse as tax rates have gotten lower. Now, let me ask one thing of David mm-hmm. K. Johnston. He mm-hmm. probably knows this. My understanding is that on Wall Street, they have relatively modest salaries and then enormous bonuses that are often multiples of the salaries. Are those bonuses taxed at capital gains rates and not ordinary income rates? And if so, that's just an incredible scam.
David?
That's a great question. It depends. Sorry to give you to waffle on that, but it depends. In some cases, they'll be taxed at capital gains rates, and the higher up you get, the more likely that will be the case. In some cases, they'll be taxed at wage rates, and in many cases, there is no tax at all now. Instead, you will defer the money, pay no taxes on it, and pay the taxes way down the road, years from now, when inflation has eroded the value of the tax.
So sometimes yes, sometimes no. Let's listen to Joe Biden and the comment that our caller Mark was talking about here, talking in September with Good Morning America's Kate Snow, said it was time for wealthy Americans, wealthier, to step it up on paying taxes.
Take a look. We want to take money and put it back in the pocket of middle-class people.
Anybody making over $250,000 is going to pay more.
You got it. It's time to be patriotic, Kate. Time to jump in. Time to be part of the deal. Time to help get America out of the rut.
Time to be patriotic on taxes, said Vice President and at that time candidate Joe Biden. Let's go to Mike in Charlotte, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. First of all, I think Nancy Kilburn, her tax problem, I think, is a little bit overblown, and she probably shouldn't have resigned for that. That's an easy mistake to make. But secondly, my main point was that I think that anybody that works for a company that put bailout money should be taxed on any bonuses they got over $50,000. At about a 75% rate for surtax,
that would be a lot of it because they're way over $50,000 in many cases. Let us pick up on that, Bob Kaiser. This expectation as we speak out of the Obama administration today, a cap of $500,000 on top executives at companies that receive big amounts of bailout money. I mean, by Wall Street standards, $500,000, that people spend that on fresh flowers in a year, Bob. How does that go down in the Washington-Wall Street axis?
Well, it's going to be startling news in New York this morning, and I'll be intrigued to see what happens. You know, we had a classic case in Washington in 2007 about trying to impose some sense on Wall Street. Charlie Rangel of New York, who's now got his own ethical problems, the newly mm-hmm. restored chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, proposed a radical notion that the income of hedge fund managers, which has been treated as capital gains, ludicrously, in my opinion, be taxed as income, the way mm-hmm. all of our salaries are taxed. Mm-hmm. And this was passed in the House, but blocked in the Senate, blocked in the easiest way of such matters. It just was never taken up. The Senate never even considered the idea. Why? Because Chuck Schumer of New York, you know, a liberal Democrat, he says, the senator from Wall Street, in fact, had accepted millions and millions of dollars in contributions for the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, of which he was the chair, from the financial services industry, which jumped up its lobbying and its contributions dramatically. This is a story I tell in my book. After Rangel's proposal was on the table and it passed the House, they really rallied round in New York and gave lots of money to Schumer. And Schumer just let the thing die. And it did die, and it's still ought to come back. But this, changing these arrangements, the way Obama and Geithner announced this morning that they were going to do on these salaries, by fiat from Washington is something we haven't seen, you know, forever. And this is going to be really big. And how it goes down and what the impact of it is and how people react to it is going to be intriguing. And one of the things that I think we can predict with confidence right now is a great public approval of this idea. Nobody out in the country is going to say, oh, you're being mean to those nice people in New York. On the contrary. And when those people in New York see how unpopular they are and begin to understand that their sense of entitlement to what they ought to get is seen to be ridiculous by the society at large, then we're going to have a different country, and it's going to be quite fun to watch.
David K. Johnston, you know that world on the upside of $500,000 a year, and there's plenty of it out there. Ken Lewis, CEO of Bank of America, took home, what, $20 million in 07, $5.75 million of that in salary and bonuses, and you can go right on down the line. How do you think Wall Street will deal with a $500,000 cap when, if it goes as many people expect, a whole lot of firms are going to have to take big bailout money?
Well, you know, we have a market, including a job market. And if you're working at one of the places that had to come to the taxpayers for a rescue and you don't like the $500,000 cap, I think you should exercise your agency and go find another job.
But are there going to be places that aren't in? I mean,
It depends on how well the business you were running was run, doesn't it? If you're going to ask the taxpayers for money, it seems to me perfectly reasonable for the taxpayers to say we're going to impose some limits here on you. But, you know, go find another job. You know, this idea that, well, if we don't pay all these guys on Wall Street these huge bonuses, they will all walk at where? Where exactly is the market that sets this price? By putting this cap on it for those businesses that took money, maybe we'll discover there is a real market. If all the talent leaves and goes to some place that didn't get any money from the government, we'll have a problem, but we'll also have discovered that, well, in fact, they are getting the real market price, not a rigged market price for their labor.
I don't know if there are that many apartments in Dubai or wherever that might be, but do you, I mean, Bob Kaiser says do this, and you've got maybe a different America coming. Is this the turn of the wheel that we're hearing here, David?
Oh, I think that this is a real turning point in America. Now, how it's going to turn out, I don't know, but Reaganism is over. We had a 28-year experiment with Reaganism. It had some successes, but did much greater damage. We've got plenty of evidence of that. You know, the bottom 90% of Americans are making the same amount of money in 2006 they made in 80, less than they made in 73. And when we get the data for 2008 and 2009, we're going to find people are making less money in the bottom 90% than they were back in 1980. The gains have gone overwhelmingly to the top. We live in a society where just 300,000 men, women, and children have the same income as the bottom half, 150 million people. It's causing terrible social problems. The number of males getting graduate degrees is declining in this country. That should be an alarming signal that the economic policies we've had are not working.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about taxes, lobbying the Washington elite, and President Barack Obama on the spot. A couple of his nominees bailing out. David K. Johnston joins us, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, author of Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal. Robert Kaiser is here, associate editor of the Washington Post and author of So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government. You can join us as well on ethics, on money and influence. Can the Obama years be different? Well, President Obama stepping up today to put, we're told, a $500,000 cap on CEOs for companies getting big federal bailout money. Here he was yesterday talking about just that.
One of the things that we're going to do tomorrow is talk about the need to control executive compensation for companies that are taking money from the federal government. If taxpayers are helping you, then you've got certain responsibilities not to be living high on the hog.
A whole lot of high on the hog out there, or has been. Where are we going now? Robert in Bethel, Vermont. You're on the air, Robert.
I just wanted to bring up an analogy with regards to resumes of people that are heading up the most important offices of our country. And here in Vermont, I've been applying for different positions with leading companies, and many of them, you have to sign off on a release where they check your taxes, they check criminal reports, they check every part of your life before and take that into account to approve you as a candidate to become an employee.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Geithner and the rest of the guys. I just don't understand how Obama could get this far down the road with resumes of people that are going to lead the country in this terrible mess that we're in that aren't even approved from a resume standpoint.
When you're out there looking down at kind of just the ordinary working guys end of the pyramid and you get checked upside down and sideways, Robert Kaiser, how about it? Was this known or much earlier not a big enough speed bump? They're too important?
Though sympathetic with Robert, I think we have to acknowledge that, for example, Tom Daschle's use of a chauffeur-driven Cadillac was not an entry on his resume. Similarly, I think Geithner's complicated tax situation when he was working at the IMF and supposed to be paying these taxes mm-hmm. himself, probably not on the resume. But on the other hand, I think it is legitimate to question the thoroughness of these vets. And in Daschle's case, sadly, it's legitimate to question his candor and forthcomingness here by not disclosing much earlier what he knew, which was that there was a potential problem with that chauffeur.
And would you describe Tom Daschle's? He wasn't a registered lobbyist, but he did a lot of what looks like lobbying work.
This is a loophole about as big as the Big Dig up there in Boston, because it allows someone who says, I never personally visit a member of Congress or a government official and ask for a favor, in effect, ask them to do something. Therefore, I am not a lobbyist. The great Clark Clifford, one of the great fixers in modern Washington's history, never registered as a lobbyist. Tommy Corcoran, who was probably the first modern lobbyist who had worked in Franklin D. Roosevelt's White House and was a very successful and wealthy lobbyist for many, many decades after that, never registered as a lobbyist in the same way that Daschle didn't, on the grounds that he never himself asked for a favor.
But describe what Daschle did. I mean, he was at Alston and Byrd. It's a lobbying firm. It's
yes,
got a lot
it is
of pharmaceutical and health services clients.
It's a law firm that lobbies. As I said at the top of the show, I think one of the great ironies here is that Daschle got all this money from a law firm, though he himself is no lawyer, never went to law school. Mm. But what did he do? Two things, I'm sure, though we're short on the specifics. One thing he did was help bring clients to Alston Byrd. If you're recommended by Tom Daschle, the former majority and minority leader of the Senate, is a private interested in search of a lobbyist, say, come over and talk to my pals at Alston and Byrd. That's a good recommendation. I'm sure it had an effect in some cases. The second thing he did was talk to the firm's clients and give them this thing we call in Washington, get your quotation marks out, strategic advice. Strategic advice is how to frame an issue in a way that it'll be appealing on Capitol Hill. In other words, find the political juice in the situation that you care about and try to turn it to your advantage. It's a very real form of advice. One of the things that we learn in this town again and again is that people coming into Washington with a new problem, corporations, institutions, whatever, individuals, fail to understand the politics of the issue they're dealing with. Someone like Tom Daschle is ideally suited to say, here's what you'll need. Here's what the Republicans are in the committee are going to ask you about. Here's what the Democrats are going to ask you about. Here's what you need to think through. Here's how you have to frame this issue and so on. That's strategic advice. It isn't called lobbying. It should be. And that's the loophole that Daschle drove
through. But maybe in that case, if indeed he was positioned to help get health care fixed, and everyone acknowledges it's a huge problem in this country, maybe his $130,000 oversight plus interest, maybe it's puny compared to the national need for that.
Well, I think that's exactly what Obama felt or hoped. And, you know, it is interesting. We should mention for your listeners the interesting fact that's in today's Washington Post that Daschle was the only person considered by the Obama transition for this job. Quote, there was no other choice, no other name, some senior official told the Post that's in the paper this morning. And that's true. Daschle was the guy for health care. He helped Obama frame his own position on health care. Everybody knew he was going to be the choice. He was the first choice, the only choice.
But can you make $5 million in 3 or 4 years in that business and then come into that powerful an office and not have obligations and conflicts of interest? Can you do it?
You know, I personally think you can do it without a sense that you have an obligation. But appearances are really important. And when you're going to go to every interested party in the country in the healthcare reform issue and say, we're asking you to make a sacrifice. We're asking you to change the way you do business. We're asking you to accept less or do more or whatever it is. And you yourself can be described as someone tainted by the money of interested parties. That just makes the job vastly more difficult. That's why, in my opinion, Daschle should not have been in this position. But, you know, those things are in the eyes of the beholders, and you're a good beholder, Tom. You understood what was going on here. But I do think it's the personal tie between Daschle and Obama that's at the root of this episode.
Let's go to Northampton, Massachusetts, and Hollis. Hi, Hollis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have an observation that this lemonade might be pretty bitter, but we may be making an investment in the future. Because I believe younger lawmakers are being told to take notice that this cutting out on their taxes hasn't worked. And if they want a career in the law or in the lawmaking branch, that they just can't do that.
But, Hollis, what about the expectation, and Bob lays it out, but that you'll go to Washington, you won't make much as a congressman, or maybe even that much as a senator, but in the years after, you will rake in the gravy and rake it in for years. Do you see a different sensibility in a different generation of politicians?
Well, apparently we supposedly had that sensibility in past years before maybe Nixon. I think of mailman writing into Time magazine back during the Nixon years and saying, it really discourages me that Nixon is paying the same taxes that I am as a mailman. So at least it was going on then and probably before. But at some point, we probably had a time when politicians did go in for service. So why can't we return to that? And the people who are just in it for the money, then let them work in the corporate world.
Hollis, thanks very much for that. David K. Johnston, here's the Wall Street Journal today kind of making fun of the concern around this. They say the political left seems to want to make this a morality play about Mr. Daschle's $5.2 million post-Senate windfall as lobbyist and speaking circuit regular, notably in front of the healthcare industry. Apparently, these people expected Mr. Daschle to return to Sioux Falls after his 2004 reelection defeat and eke out a hardscrabble existence as a farmer.
Gee, I'm shocked. The editorial page of the Wall Street Journal thinks that public life is about getting rich. Shocking, shocking. You know, Charles Peters, who founded a wonderful little public policy magazine that's still around called the Washington Monthly, has a saying. People come to Washington to do well and end up – I'm sorry, to do good and end up doing well. There's a real problem with this, and I'm was particularly troubled by the line in the Post that I wasn't aware of till Bob mentioned it, that the only candidate for HHS secretary they considered was Daschle. One of the primary lessons that you should learn from management, we teach it to our military officers, to our business graduate students, is options. You want to have lots of options. What do we do? What do we do when we're under stress? What options do we have? And there are lots of people who are qualified to help us get to a healthcare system that instead of throwing sand, if not stones, in the gears of commerce in this country will help us be more efficient in our economy and more humane and catch up with all the rest of the modern world against which we're competing economically. So that's actually troubling that they didn't think, that President Obama did not think about, well, who are the alternatives?
On the other hand, at least for the day yesterday, that kind of chastened Obama, I found a real change of pace in appealing, sort of saying, okay, I screwed up. We're working on this a step at a time. We're going to do it differently. And let's hope they can and do it. A message goes with that. Anne in Natick, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Anne.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a point, which I think has been alluded to by your guests, that there's not much that the Obama administration, in my opinion, is going to be able to do to change the situation unless they have the full cooperation of the press. Because
what would that mean? What would that mean, Anne?
Well, less picking and choosing who is going to be on the hot seat. And I take as an example the Boston Globe in 1988 during the presidential campaign, when George H.W. Bush was running, I remember seeing a very small article on one of the back pages that talked about George H.W. Bush owing well over $100,000 in back taxes at the time. Now, this was pretty much buried. And I think that as long as the press sort of picks and chooses who they're going to turn the spotlight on for these issues, we're going to have a lot of trouble. And I think that the Obama administration is going to have a really hard time making its point.
And that is very, and your memory is better than mine, but it's a very interesting point. On the other hand, when the press makes much of these kind of failings. I mean, isn't that what Obama promised on the campaign trail? He promised change. He promised ethics, an era of responsibility in the inaugural speech. Isn't that the press's job? And with this president and that message in particular.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree. But what my concern is, and I think that your guests have alluded to this, is that you have certain members of the press that say, this is terrible, you know, this is, you know, we want to hold to these standards, and other members of the press who are like, well, you know, business as usual, or, you know, is this not so, you know, this really won't make that much of a difference, or, you know, we can get over this.
Right. When does the spotlight get turned on, and when doesn't it? And thanks, Bob Kaiser. How about it, the balance of terror here in the press going after these issues?
Well,
is it a favor for Obama and his theme, or is it unfair to go strong on these when we've seen years of lapses, failings, corruption?
Let me first ask David, do you remember this story about Bush owing the elder Bush owing $100,000? I don't.
I don't. I do report in Free Lunch and in Perfectly Legal about how George Bush, the most recent George Bush president, cheated on his taxes.
Yes, we know I read that. It was wonderful. Yeah.
Yes. Ronald Reagan famously, after he said taxes should hurt, turned out he hadn't paid any taxes. And you may recall Richard Nixon, it turned out, didn't pay any taxes because of backdated documents. So there's a long history of this. But Bob, I'll bet you agree with me about this. It's not our job to pull punches for people.
Of course,
we should treat the Obama administration with the same with the same scrutiny and fairness that we've treated others. Now, I know there are people out there going, "Wait a minute! A lot of the press took a dive on George Bush," or "Wait a minute! A lot of the press was anti-George Bush." There's a competitive market out there, and people have different viewpoints, and they're going to see this in different ways.
But Bob Kaiser, to Ann's central point, she sees, as a lot of Americans will, a huge and crisis agenda almost of things that need addressing. In the face of that, do the kind of problems that we're talking about here need full attention, or do they need to be shunted slightly to the side to get on with business and fixing, or is it all one? Can you fix this country's problems without addressing the money-power nexus you write about?
I think not. I also think that we have to acknowledge that irony is the lifeblood of journalism, and any public figure who sets himself up, you know, Mark Phelps is in this category today, who appears to be one thing and then turns out to be something very different, is inevitably going to attract a lot of attention.
Olympian
from the
popular with the culture. Bong hit photos out there.
Right. Go ahead,
David.
No, go ahead, Bob. I'm sorry.
I'm finished.
Tom, let me make one little point about the Obama administration, because they're having a lot of problems starting up, even though they, you know, immediately after the election began to go into transition mode. I called the White House press office, and I've been calling that number back to Nixon the day after the election. It rang and rang and rang and went to a voicemail box that said it was full until Tuesday, a full week after the inauguration. I got a young man who bristled at being asked to spell his name, refused to give me his title, then said off the record, and I stopped him and said, "I'm sorry, I do not speak to official spokesman for the White House off the record." He hung up on me. I eventually got, after another call, to an assistant press secretary who bristled at giving his name, who said off the record, and I had to stop him. And in some ways, Obama's administration will end up shooting itself in the foot if they don't get a grown-up professional press operation that every previous administration has had.
David, duly noted, though we're not going to judge this whole great show on the press office quite yet.
No.
Maybe a little humility injection with the Daschle tale and the Killifer tale in the Obama administration right now. Certainly in the Oval Office, it looked that way last night. And the American public looking on with all these challenges.
The reason I think this is relevant, Tom, excuse me, is that what we've learned this week is indeed how entrenched this problem is. And if we don't help him realize that, that we're not doing our job, and if he can't confront it, he won't be able to do his.
Wake-up calls all around in the Daschle and Killifer stories, and our gratitude to each of you for helping us look at those today. David K. Johnston, author of Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal. David, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Robert Kaiser, associate editor at the Washington Post, author of the new book, So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government. Bob Kaiser, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.